broth, soft-boiled eggs, tea, and toast. When she wasn't bringing something to eat or refilling Anna's teacup, she was at hand with compresses. The smell of camphor oil on warmed flannel was comforting and effective both, wrapped around her throat. She sweated through the bedclothes and sheets, and then sat by watching as Mrs. Cabot changed it all so that she could go back to sleep in a cool, sweet-smelling cocoon. All day while Anna was being pampered, Jack slept on a narrow bed in a room down the hall. When she woke in the later afternoon, she forgot for a moment why she was in bed in the light of day alone. Then she swallowed, and the ache in her throat, much better already, reminded her. Jack was gone again, back to Mulberry Street to work on the Campbell case. On Thursday, she would go back to her own patients and students, to staff meetings and consultations. She glanced at the stack of journals waiting to be read, turned over, and went back to sleep. To dream about the family she had lost, and the one she might make with Jack. Chapter 40. When Jack came home at 6 on Tuesday morning, he found a note on the banister where he could not possibly miss it. "Don't you dare go to sleep until you come talk to me." He went up the stairs at a trot, half expecting her to be asleep, and wondering if waking her would make her more or less cranky. The simple truth was, he wanted some time with his wife, whatever her mood. The door stood open and showed him Anna sitting up in bed reading. She hadn't heard him, and so he stopped to watch her for a moment. She had tied her hair back and out of her face with a wide silk ribbon, not equal to the task of subduing the riot of waves and curls. While she read, a medical journal, of course, she wound a finger through a long loose curl, tugging. There was noise from the street and the flutter of the curtains in a fitful breeze, but all her attention was on her reading. If he could paint, Jack thought, this was the painting he would want. Anna in sunlight, reading. During the day, sometimes the memory of her came to him as unanticipated as a flash of lightning. Anna underneath him, shoulders thrown back, throat arched, her gaze fixed on his as he inched her closer and closer to letting go. It had never really been clear to him before Anna, but he understood now what an act of trust it was, what a gift she gave him when she surrendered. Now the simple sight of her made him forget the weariness etched into his bones. He shook himself out of his daydream, and she looked up.
"There you are. Come talk to me."
The ribbon in her hair was a deep copper color that somehow brought out the green in her hazel eyes. He would tell her so. He wanted to tell her so, but she would fluster and turn away. He said, "You're better."
"Almost."
"You don't sound so much like a 70-year-old cigar fiend."
First one dimple, then the other. "What a lovely image."
He laughed and sat down on the opposite side of the bed, canted to face her.
"I think I'll be able to go back to work on Thursday," she said. "That leaves 2 days, and I promise you I'll go crazy if I have to stay in this bed the whole time."
She picked up a teacup from the bedside table, wrinkling her nose at the taste.
"I've never understood the concept of laziness. Doing nothing all day is torture."
He said, "Maybe this will help." He put a folder on the bed, a little grubby on the edges, Oscar's handwriting scrambling over the surface like ants. "I thought you might want to see what Lambert came up with. I brought copies of the Liljestrom and Campbell reports and the 3 he finished last night. He hopes to get the last 3 done by tomorrow morning."
The smile she gave him took his breath away. He wondered what else would make her smile like that. Diamonds? A trip to London? A hospital of her own?
"Anna?"
She looked up at him. What do you like to do for fun? Confusion flashed across her face. What do you mean, for fun? And there exactly was the heart of the matter. Anna's heart. He said, when you have an hour or a day to yourself and no deadlines and no place to be, when you can please yourself, what do you do? And then, this isn't an exam. There's no right answer. But there's always something that needs to be done. This is a hypothetical question. All work done, everything sorted, people looked after, no deadlines, a day free. What would you like to do with that time? What would make you happy? I'm not sure I like this hypothetical question. Is there a trick in it somewhere? He leaned over and kissed her forehead, damp and cool. No, never mind. It was just a theory I was testing. She was frowning at him, but he could almost see her attention drifting back to the folder in her hands. He had his answer. For fun, Anna liked to think about medicine. She liked many other things, coffee and high places, little girls laughing, flower gardens and the sea. But fun was a difficult concept. The stories she told about Sophie and Cap when they were children made him think she once had been able to be spontaneous, but somewhere along the line she had forgotten what it felt like to simply enjoy herself. Outside their bed, at least, she didn't seem to understand the concept. She was reading the first report and had forgotten that he was standing there. He tried to catch the yawn that overwhelmed him, and failed. Instead, he got up and began to strip. Jacket, tie, collar. With one hand, he started unbuttoning his shirt, while with the other, he dropped a suspender over a shoulder. Then he saw the look on her face. Astonishment, maybe. Amusement tinged with irritation. What?
Mezzanotte, you're standing in front of the windows. Open windows, curtains drawn back.
He waited, raised a brow.
What would you say if I stood in the windows and stripped for the whole neighborhood to stare at? You'd be shocked, wouldn't you?
Surprised is more the word that comes to mind. Maybe also a little engaged. Her jaw dropped open and then closed with a click.
Don't change the subject. Explain to me this compulsion you have about walking naked around the house.
He draped his trousers over a chair back and came to sit on the bed, his legs stretched out before him and his hands folded over his middle. You know, Savard, for a credentialed doctor and surgeon, you can be very prudish. She bristled, which was what he was after, and then she surprised him.
Did it ever occur to you that I don't want to share you?
He let out a bark of a laugh, and she poked him with one finger, hard.
In some parts of the world, women wear dark veils every day, regardless of the weather, she told him, because their husbands don't want other men looking at them or coveting them. It could work the other way around, too, in theory.
He ran a finger from her throat to the first button of her chemise, and she shivered. How do you know about the habits of veiled women in other parts of the world? She sighed in mock irritation and put the folder aside. Jack was quite pleased with her about this, but he didn't let it show.
You still don't understand what kind of place the New Amsterdam is. Poor women come in all colors and shapes and fashions. I've treated women from places you've never heard of.
You think? He made a rake of his fingers and slid them through a strand of her hair. I was always good at geography. Try me.
Wait.
She jumped up and ran down the hall to a room still filled with unpacked boxes. Because she was wearing a chemise and nothing else, he quite enjoyed this small interruption. She came back at a more measured pace, with a very large book in her arms.
my atlas. This way we can check each other.
She dropped it on his lap. Careful, he said, shifting uncomfortably. You are gambling with our progeny.
She climbed up on the bed and sat back on her heels, her hands folded in front of herself. I had a patient from Abyssinia last year. There was something compelling about Anna in a mood like this, absolutely determined to win a battle of wits. He'd draw it out as long as he could.
If I'm not mistaken, he said, Abyssinia borders on the Mediterranean Sea in the north and the Red Sea in the south. The Nile runs the whole length of it. You've got to do better than that to trip me up, Savard. I was always good at geography.
And languages.
That too.
What he wanted to do was to get rid of the atlas she had taken back to hold in front of her like a warrior queen's shield, and then tumble her, cold or no cold.
He said, does it have to be a country?
As opposed to what? She wanted to know. Continents?
He shrugged. States, counties, shires, provinces, cities.
Suit yourself, but stay within the realm of fair play.
But first, you go on until I miss one.
Fine, she said, composing her expression. Basutu land.
Africa, Jack said. If I had to guess, the far south. One of the British colonies, probably. I'll guess near the Cape Colony.
She put on her most disinterested expression, tilted her head to one side. Kiva.
Spell it.
K-H-I-V-A.
You had a patient from Kiva?
I'm setting the questions, mezzanotte. Answer or admit defeat.
Don't know.
She narrowed her eyes at him. I think you do.
That made him really laugh. Why would I lie?
To stop the game. But you've missed a question, and it's your turn to ask me.
He tugged on a strand of her hair. If you insist. Brunei, spelled B-R-U-N-E-I.
E-I is the word for egg in German.
That's your answer. Brunei is a state or a principality in Germany?
Not an answer. It was a guess.
I'm feeling magnanimous. One more try.
She tapped her forehead with one knuckle. Wait, it's coming to me. Brunei is a Swiss canton on the Austrian border.
He wrestled the book out of her hands and dropped it over the side of the bed, which made her squawk.
That's a valuable atlas.
I've got a bigger one. Lift up.
He tugged at the hem of her chemise, caught beneath her knees. She slapped his hands away. No.
No? Why not?
I need a reason.
I'll give you a reason, he said, tugging harder. I'm rewarding you for that stunning example of a bluff. There's no Swiss canton called Brunei. Now, are you going to lift up?
No, she was trying not to laugh.
Well, then, he shrugged, I'll have to peel you like a banana.
She didn't try very hard to stop him, and the buttons were no challenge at all. The thin muslin slid off her shoulders and down her arms to stop at her elbows. With her breasts looking at him cheerfully, Jack said,
I've got an idea for a different kind of geography quiz. And this one, I'm pretty sure you'll win.
Tell me, Anna said a half hour later, still trying to catch her breath. Do people just stop doing this when the real heat starts next month? She felt him smiling, but he rolled to one side so the breeze from the window could wash over her.
Is that better?
I wasn't complaining. Do people stop in hot weather?
He said. Don't tell me you've forgotten the bathtub.
Anna giggled and was surprised at herself for it. Jack lifted his head to peek at her, gave a low sound of satisfaction, and dropped it again.
So, he said, You were telling me about men covering up women to ward off the interest of other men. Do you want me to wear a veil and robes?
Anna took a journal from under her pillow and began to flap it like a fan. I'm considering it.
And then,
you know the strangest thing about being married?
He lifted his head again, one brow raised.
The playfulness. I never anticipated that. And now it makes me sad to think I might have gone my whole life without it. Did you expect it to be like this?
I hoped, is the way I'd put it.
But how did you know how to hope for it?
My parents, he said. They are affectionate with each other. And my brothers have that too with their wives, each in his own way.
He thought for a moment.
Some more successfully than others.
Is that an Italian thing, do you think?
He wiped a trickle of sweat from his brow. I couldn't claim that. You remember Giacalone the tailor?
Now that you remind me, why did you kill your wife in Sicilian?
He grinned at her. We are an emotional people in all directions.
From the stories, I think my parents were affectionate, Anna said. She was quiet, but he could hear her thoughts spinning, and he understood.
I have an idea.
Not another geography quiz.
Not right now. I'm wondering why you don't write down what you want to tell me that you're having such a hard time talking about.
Her surprise was genuine, and it struck him again how intelligent people could be robbed of all ability to think rationally when it came to matters of the heart. I can try, she said. She sat up. Maybe today when I'm done reading the reports. You need to sleep now.
She tried to roll out of bed, but he stopped her. Stay with me 10 minutes, he said.
With the light breeze from the window shifting over their damp skin, every nerve in his body still vibrating, he put his face to her scalp to draw in her scent and fell asleep. Anna began to drift off too, but 5 minutes later she sat up in bed with her hands pressed to her mouth.
What? Jack sat up too. What?
Her eyes were very round.
Anna, he said firmly. What is it? A nightmare?
My cervical cap, she said. I completely forgot my cervical cap. Her eyes raced back and forth as if she were searching for something. Then she drew a deep breath and held it for 3 heartbeats. I think it will be all right. The timing is good.
Good. For what?
Ovulation, or rather the lack of it. I'm at the end of my cycle, not in the middle. Promise me we won't lose our heads like that again.
Anna, he said, brushing a curl off her damp cheek. We'll get carried away plenty, but I promise I'll ask about the cervical cap first.
She nodded, yawning. Good, she said. I should get up now. Or you really will catch my cold. That made him laugh. He was still laughing when she slipped away and left him to his dreams. While Jack slept, Anna read the postmortem reports, making notes and charts until she could no longer deny that there was a pattern. She had been so sure that Janine Campbell had tried to operate on herself, because she couldn't imagine anyone, man or woman, purposefully injuring another human being in such a blatantly cruel way. She was no stranger to violence, to gunshots and stabbings, beatings and burns. Men were endlessly inventive when it came to hurting women. She understood this. And still, here was the evidence that she was neither as worldly or cynical as she had believed herself to be. It all made her miss Sophie more acutely. There was so much to miss about her cousin. The sound of her voice, the way she hummed when she went about some household chore, her dry sense of humor, Anna missed all those things. But just now, sitting with the autopsy reports spread out in front of her, she missed Sophie's medical mind most. As diagnosticians, they complemented each other, and Sophie would have had useful observations that Anna missed entirely. In the afternoon, Jack got up to start his day, and Anna said as much to him. As I have to do without Sophie, can I ask my cousin Amelie her opinion about the autopsies? She has more experience than Nicholas Lambert and I do even put together. Something here might trigger a useful association. Jack liked the idea, so she wrote out a case-by-case summary along with her own observations and put it all in an envelope that she addressed to her cousin.
Ask Ned to mail it for you,
Jack had suggested. Anna made a sound into her teacup that she hoped he would take for agreement. The truth was, she had a small plan. An innocent plan, really. One that was unlikely to turn up any new information, and thus, she told herself, best kept to herself for the time being. Except Elise came to call in the early evening, and Anna remembered there was another mind available to her. She lacked experience, but that might even work to their favor. Clear-sighted and without prior assumptions, Elise might see something. She debated with herself while Elise talked about what was going on at Rose's. Mrs. Lee had declared the little girls to be healthy again, freeing them to bounce around the house and garden like frogs on a griddle for the entire afternoon. Margaret had predicted tears before bedtime, and Aunt Quinlan had made a rude sound to that idea and called the girls to her.
They wanted to come see you, but your aunt said they had to give you another day.
Anna wanted to hear the stories Elise had to tell, but her mind kept turning back to the reports. Elise was saying,
reading a story by Mark Twain that had everybody laughing, and then, are you tired? Shall I go?
Not in the least, really. How are things at the hospital? It was like offering water to a man in the desert. Elise told her about the surgeries she had observed in the last week, stopping to ask Anna questions and to consider the answers.
Do you think you might want to take up surgery?
Elise didn't have to think about her answer.
I'm more comfortable on the other end of things, working with the patients directly. I like the challenge of figuring out what's really wrong. Diagnosis,
Anna said.
That was the impression I had. So I'm wondering if you might find it interesting to read these post-mortem reports I've been looking at.
She put her hand on the folder. Elise's whole posture changed.
I've never seen a post-mortem.
That's why I thought you might be interested. She gestured to a chair. Sit down. Let me explain. Elise took an hour to read through the reports, and then she sat looking out the window for a good while. The day hadn't yet begun to wane, though it was already 8. People were drawn outdoors by the light and the fine weather, the silky touch of a warm breeze. Somewhere in the city was a man who had caused the deaths of at least 5 women, and maybe as many as 8, without anyone taking notice. He went about his business without interference, because he showed an unremarkable face to the world. Unless he walked down the street with a bloody knife in his hand, he could go on just as he had started. An apple that looked solid until you bit into it to find your mouth full of worms. She turned to look across the room. Anna was sitting in the corner of a sofa, her cheek against her hand while she read. She sensed Elise looking at her and met her eye.
Thoughts? A few observations, but I doubt they're significant.
Go on. Don't leave anything out.
This felt like a recitation in the lecture hall.
Elise organized her thoughts and started.
This doctor. I think he must be a doctor, given some of these details, started to perform these operations with two goals in mind. He wanted the patient to die in terrible pain, but he wanted the death itself to take place out of his sight. With Mrs. Campbell, he was too violent, and with Mrs. Liljeström, he was so fast that he damaged an artery and she hemorrhaged immediately and bled to death. So neither case satisfied him. But in the third, fourth, and fifth cases, he had settled on a procedure that gave him the result he wanted, and then he was exacting. The incisions are all in the fundus between the uterine horns and spaced evenly, like tick marks on a tally sheet, 1, 2, 3. All of them are angled to cut into the intestines to a depth of about 2 inches. The instrument was not sterilized, and it might even have been purposefully contaminated. That seems likely, given how quickly the infection took hold and spread.
She looked up from the report in front of her.
Shall I go on? I have just a few more thoughts.
Anna said, "It's useful to hear someone else's interpretation, so please do."
I was thinking of how a patient is prepared for surgery of this kind. If these women had marks on their arms and legs that indicated they had been forcibly restrained, would Dr. Lambert have noted that?
Anna's brows rose sharply.
Why do you ask? Because if there were no restraints, he must have used anesthesia. The natural impulse would be to twist away from the pain. I'll tell you what I think probably happened.
She got up and walked back and forth for a moment to gather her thoughts.
I think this person must be someone who is very well established, or at least he has that appearance. He presents himself as a highly educated medical authority with broad experience. He won't be very young, and his fees will be exorbitant. Do you happen to know?
Yes, the fees were very high, between $200 and $300. It took a moment for Elise to make sense of such a large number.
So these women would expect someone with a professional demeanor, she went on more slowly, someone severe and a little frightening, but not unkind. I'm not being clear. Do you know what I mean?
The strict but benevolent father, Anna said. Elise was feeling a little more comfortable now, and she let the story come out in the way she imagined it.
The patients will have high expectations. He must have some kind of medical office or clinic, treatment and operating rooms, and the right equipment, everything in good working order and well maintained. A pleasant waiting room, and there must be an assistant or nurse, certainly, someone to help the patients undress and dress again, and someone, maybe the same person, to administer anesthesia. He does this horrible thing, but then he wants it out of his sight because he's feeling vulnerable, maybe, or superstitious, or just guilty. He might be worried about evidence, I suppose. To get her out of his office as quickly as possible, he will have to administer a good amount of laudanum, so that she's far away when she realizes that something is very wrong. There are other autopsy reports coming?
There will be, Anna said, by the end of the day tomorrow. Would you like to see those when Jack brings them home? This question felt very much like a quiz. She wondered what Anna wanted to hear and decided that it didn't really matter. She told the truth.
I'd be very interested if I can be of help.
I think you can, Anna said, and finally she produced a smile. It's immodest of me, but I take some pride in how quickly you're learning to think like a doctor. And now I'm going to tell you a secret. Ready?
Yes.
If you feel like you're being tested, you are. In medicine, at least. If that's the case, don't watch the person who asks the question, for two reasons. First, the more you look at that person for signs of approval, the less likely you are to see any facial expression at all. Second, don't be afraid of silence. It's an old trick to use silence as another kind of test.
It's a way to determine how confident you are of your answers. If you don't know, say so. If you do know, say that and stop talking.
Elise couldn't quite keep from smiling.
Go on, Anna said. Say what you're thinking.
I'm thinking you remind me of some of the nuns.
Her mouth twitched at the corner. Anyone in particular? Feeling a little lightheaded, Elise stood up and walked to the door. She chanced to look at Anna, who had one brow raised. Elise said,
"Yes,"
and left the room without looking back over her shoulder. Chapter 41. Dressed to go to the shops, Anna told Mrs. Cabot that she would be out for an hour. Mrs. Cabot said,
"Hmm."
Anna said, "I'm just going to the post office." She might have tried to show her dimples, but the housekeeper had already proved herself immune. Mrs. Cabot said,
"Ned will be by any minute. I'll send him to the post office for you."
Anna didn't need Ned along on this outing. She wasn't entirely sure herself what she hoped to accomplish, a fact that would be immediately obvious when he started asking questions.
"I need the exercise," Anna said in a tone that any one of her students would recognize as enough.
"I don't like it."
Mrs. Cabot was more like Mrs. Lee every day.
"My cold is almost completely gone," Anna countered. "It's 72 degrees with a light breeze. The sun is shining. The fresh air will do me good." In fact, the air and the exercise did her a great deal of good. It was such a relief to be out of doors that for a few minutes, Anna walked at a steady pace, feeling nothing but the sun on her face and an odd contentment. She turned onto 9th Street and picked up her pace, picked up her skirts and stepped around the worst of the rubbish in the street. The smell of ripe trash in the sun was unavoidable in New York in the summer. In fact, that meant summer had really arrived in Anna's mind. At the next corner, she stopped, fishing in her pocket for coins for an old couple, the man holding out a tin cup. He smiled up at her with such obvious pleasure that she was taken aback for a moment.
"It's Dr. Anna."
He peered at her from the rolling platform that did the work of his missing legs. Another veteran, one who had survived the worst and was still here, managing from day to day. He elbowed the woman next to him.
"Sari, it's Dr. Anna. You looked after our grandson when his knee went bad in February. Pavel Zolovsky, if you recall. Our girl Judy married a Polak, you see. You came out to tell us how things stood after you fixed Pavel up."
"I remember," Anna said. "Of course I remember. A very lively boy. How is he?"
"Right as right can be,"
said the old woman. Her eyes scanned back and forth, sightless but still seeking. Anna would stay and listen if they wanted to tell her about their grandson, but she asked no intrusive questions. The poor had every right to their privacy and dignity. After a moment, she put coins into the old woman's hand directly, smiled at her husband, and took her leave. It was easy to get turned around among the market stalls. The aisles were narrow and the crowds shifted in unpredictable ways that seemed designed to halt her progress. Most of the market sellers fell into one of two categories: the overly friendly, loud-voiced but engaging seducer, she passed one who was juggling spoons while he flirted with passers-by, and the irascible, curt ones who always had the best merchandise. She found her way to the little post office on West 10th Street and mailed the letter to Amelie, then made a plan. First, a turn around the market. She bought some boiled sweets, a few yards of silk gauze that she rolled into a sausage shape that fit into her reticule, a card of pretty carved shell buttons. She studied ducks hanging in the butcher's window and shoes in the cobbler's. On Greenwich,
A clerk walked back and forth in front of the milliner's shop, showing off the newest fashion and trying to draw passers-by in for a look. When she had made a full tour of the market, Anna crossed 6th Avenue again and went straight to Smithson's. It had been a very long time since she had last been in the apothecary, but it seemed to Anna that nothing had changed. Sets of scales hung from the ceiling, heavy wood counters and glass-fronted cabinets, a wall of small drawers with printed labels, jars arranged in neat rows on deep shelves. Even early on a summer day, the gas lights were turned up high to combat the gloomy, tunnel-like atmosphere of 6th Avenue overhung by the elevated train. A younger man was busy topping up a china canister from a far less attractive stoneware crock. Anna couldn't see the names from where she stood, but the sweet, sharp tang of bitter orange, Aurantii cortex, hung in the air. There was mint, too, and less pleasant but familiar smells, some chemical, some botanical. A woman came into the shop from a back room, and here was proof that things had indeed changed. Not a clerk, by her demeanor or dress. Smithson had sons. This might be a daughter-in-law or a granddaughter. She was neatly and very fashionably dressed in a suit of dark gray summer weight wool with a tasteful bustle and a waist cinched down to no more than 20 inches. A black velvet band around her neck was held closed by a jet mourning brooch, small but very pretty.
May I help you?
Yes, I hope so. Anna came closer. I am trying to get in touch with a midwife who used to work in this neighborhood, but no one seems to know where she's gone. Do you keep in touch with local midwives?
We do, within limitations.
Anna skated right by that conversational opening.
Her name is Amélie Savard.
The cool blue gaze focused on something behind Anna and then came back to her.
I'm sorry, I can't help you with that.
She seemed to remember her manners just that easily.
I'm Nora Smithson. My husband is the apothecary.
It's been a very long time since my last visit, Anna offered. I was away in Europe for a good while. The secret to successful lying she had observed over the years was to stick with just that part of the truth you needed, Mrs. Smithson said.
You might remember my father-in-law. He retired last year. May I say, without presuming, if you are in need of a midwife, there are a number who work with us who have excellent reputations. Would you like a copy of the list we keep?
Mrs. Smithson smiled at her in the way women sometimes smiled at newly expectant mothers. Anna was glad to be spared the necessity of lying outright.
I would, yes, please. If I may suggest, she went on, her voice lowered, you might consider a physician. There are specialists in women's health who also have excellent reputations and attending privileges at one or more of the local hospitals. Medical science had advanced beyond midwifery.
Ah, Anna hesitated, unsure how to proceed. Would you have names? This earned her a very sincere smile.
Of course. I'll give you both lists.
She turned away to take something out of a drawer. Turning back, Anna saw that she had more to say and was looking for an opening.
Is something wrong?
No. Well, not exactly.
May I ask, where did you hear the name Amélie Savard?
This Anna had prepared for.
Neighbors are very kind with advice about greengrocers and butchers and dry goods stores, and I heard the name from an elderly lady who lives next door. She said that Mrs. Savard was an excellent midwife.
Mrs. Smithson was chewing delicately on her lower lip.
Does this neighbor have children?
Anna paused, thinking, and decided to depart from the truth in this much.
I don't actually know. They would be middle-aged if she does.
Another small nod.
Despite what you were told, Amélie Savard was not a midwife.
Anna raised a brow, as much invitation as she could trust herself to give. She was an abortionist in the model of Madame Restelle. You have heard of Madame Restelle? She lived in a mansion on Fifth Avenue.
Ah, Anna said. I haven't kept up with the laws.
There are still abortionists about, Mrs. Smithson said. But they don't come in here. They wouldn't dare. We alerted Mr. Comstock about the Savard woman, and she left town just like that. She snapped her fingers.
It would not do to show emotion at this moment, no matter how blatant the lies and misrepresentations about her cousin. But neither could she leave it completely alone.
I wonder what a lady does when she has too many children and no way to feed them. Do the physicians on your list help in that kind of situation?
Color rushed up Mrs. Smithson's face so quickly that Anna was taken aback.
If you came here for that purpose, you have indeed come to the wrong apothecary. I suggest you leave now.
She reached out to take back the two sheets of paper in Anna's hands, but Anna saw her purpose and stepped back from the counter.
You mistake me, she said firmly. I am not looking for an abortionist. I asked a question, and you have insulted me on that basis. Do you regularly abuse and condescend to your customers?
I... A hand crept up to her face and then pressed into her mouth. Through her fingers, she said,
I apologize most sincerely. I overreacted, and I apologize.
Anna stayed where she was, her expression frozen.
It's a sensitive subject. I do apologize, Mrs.
Apology accepted. Anna made her voice as cold as she could. And now, I wish you a good day. Anna hated wishing people a good day. She found it insipid and insincere and never used the expression. Except just now. Because if she hadn't said, I wish you a good day, she would have said something far more colorful. She would have called Mrs. Smithson a lying, sanctimonious bitch. Anna said it now in her head. Now at least she understood why Amelie had given up her midwifery practice. Hundreds and hundreds of children delivered safely, mothers sustained and kept healthy, and all that was left of the goodwill accumulated over those years was this one idea. If Mrs. Smithson had started talking about the color of Amelie's skin, Anna would have called her a bitch, and worse. As soon as she was around the corner and out of sight, she began to shake. Her hands trembled so that at first she couldn't even get the lists she had been given into her reticule. Then she stood quietly and made herself take three deep breaths. When she looked up, she saw the little coffee house that sat on the corner, where Greenwich, Christopher, and Sixth Avenue converged opposite the Jefferson Market. Before the war, she had come here sometimes with Uncle Quinlan. He liked the tobacconist on the next block, and so she would come along first thing and they would have breakfast together. As far as Anna knew, the place had no name and never had. She sometimes heard it called the Jefferson Market Coffee House, or the Blue Coffee House, and sometimes the French Coffee House, because the owners had moved down from Montreal and spoke French to each other. The idea of going home to more chamomile tea was insupportable. Anna crossed Sixth Avenue once again, stepping quickly out of the way of a dray and then a cab, waiting while a stream of people descended from the elevated train platform. She thought again of home. She thought of coffee and was newly resolved. It was a small place, very busy, very plain. The wife took her order, coffee and toast, and didn't seem to recognize Anna, which was what she had hoped. It would be very unfortunate if Mrs. Smithson came in here at exactly the wrong moment and heard someone call her Dr. Savard. The coffee was served in the French way, in a cup like a bowl, milky and slightly sweet. Anna sipped and watched people coming and going, up and down the stairs to the train,
across Greenwich to the market, across 6th to the shops. 2 roundsmen came in and were greeted congenially. News and a few bad puns were traded. There was talk of a robbery on the next block. Windows broken, but little of worth taken. An old man found dead in Knucklebone Alley. Another man had lost his job at the refinery. And a third, disgusted with the city, had packed up his family and moved to Ohio. In the half hour she took to drink her coffee, people came and went. More police, shoppers, a doctor she recognized from the northern dispensary just down the street. He didn't notice her, and she couldn't remember his name. 3 finely dressed older men came in, all of them in shining good health, polished and buffed. One had a walking stick with a jewel embedded in its head. Anna guessed them to be judges from the district courthouse behind the market. They were sure of themselves in this less-than-first-class neighborhood, but then, who would dare rob a judge surrounded by police officers? Anna had known some very handy children who could have managed to pick such pockets, but the cane would be harder to nick. She counted out 15 cents for her toast and coffee, added a nickel for a tip, made sure of her reticule, and left, inclining her head to one of the judges who bowed from the shoulders. As she left the coffee house, another stream of people came down the stairs from the elevated train platform. Businessmen and lawyers, most likely on their way to one courtroom or another, an irritated middle-aged woman with 3 school-age boys, and at last, one elderly man, moving slowly. His cane was well used and not for show. Step by step he felt his way down, his posture exacting. There was something in his face that spoke of joint pain, barely kept within the bounds of what a person could tolerate and stay upright. Anna knew this look from her aunt and felt a swell of empathy. She wondered if his hips were the problem, or his knees, or both. He must have felt her gaze because his head came up, and he looked at her directly. One corner of his mouth twitched, and then curved downward, as if he had seen something objectionable. It was not surprising that he'd take offense. Medicine had instilled some very bad habits, and one of them was staring at people trying to diagnose what might be wrong. She had been staring. She hesitated, wondering if she should speak to him or if that would make things worse. Turning away, she felt him watching her, repaying her in kind. A glance over her shoulder showed him still standing on the stairs, one hand on the banister. As she looked, his frown deepened, and he thumped with his cane, very deliberately. Once, twice, 3 times, like the gavel of a judge. She put the old man out of her mind, and Mrs. Smithson immediately took his place. Of course, she would have to tell Jack about their conversation, and she considered how best to do that while she walked. The plain truth was the best option. She had let her curiosity get the best of her. That thought was still in her mind when she got home, ready to confess, and found that Jack had been called back to Mulberry Street and wasn't expected before early Thursday morning, most likely when Anna had already left for the hospital. Her mood deflated. She ate a bowl of Mrs. Cabot's broth and a few crackers, drank what seemed like another quart of tea infused with honey and lemon, and took a few minutes to write a message for Ned to take to the New Amsterdam. She would be back at work tomorrow at 6:30. "I'm going to go to sleep for a few hours," she told Mrs. Cabot, "but call if someone needs me." There was a half-smile that Anna already recognized as Mrs. Cabot's quiet opposition. "Oh, yeah," she said. "That's just exactly what I'll do." When Jack got to Mulberry Street, he found Maroney, Sainsbury, and Larkin sitting around the table listening to Nicholas Lambert, who was going over his notes on the rest of the autopsies.
So Jack leaned against the door and listened, his chin on his chest. Lambert was saying, "Of the 8 cases, the first 2 are significantly different. But there are similarities enough to group them all together as the work of one person. I have to write up the last 3 reports and a summary of my findings, but I thought you'd want to hear this much right away."
Oscar said, "It's good to know what we're dealing with. Any ideas about the person responsible?"
"Do you mean who it might be?" He shook his head. "It could be anyone. Whoever is doing this must have learned how to present a normal face to the world. The most I can say is that this is the work of someone familiar with human anatomy and well-versed in how to cause maximum damage and pain. Whoever he is, I hope he steps in front of an omnibus before he gets around to harming another woman."
When he had gone, they sat staring at each other for a long moment. Interviews with cabbies, hotel employees, hospital staff had all come to nothing. And neither had the letters written to the doctors advertising in the newspaper. This thought was still in Jack's mind when Sainsbury looked up and said,
"This may be a stupid idea." To all ladies resident in the city or environs, be warned. An unidentified person claiming to be a physician has been advertising in all the newspapers offering his services to ladies who are seeking what is sometimes called the restoration of nature's rhythms, or the removal of obstructions. This person may sign himself Dr. DePaul or use other names. He is being sought by the police in connection with a number of homicides of a particularly heinous nature. For your own safety, do not communicate with anyone advertising such services unless the physician provides valid references from both patients and colleagues. Any information about this person should be directed to Detective Sergeant Maroney at Police Headquarters on Mulberry. A private citizen has made funds available to reward individuals providing information that leads to apprehension and conviction of the guilty party.
They talked about it for an hour, discussed the fine points and how to deal with what would certainly turn into a badgering by the press. A runner came to the door. Jack took the message slips, read them, and then raised a brow in Oscar's direction. He said,
"You want the good news or the bad news first?"
"Will we be able to tell the difference?"
"Probably not." "Then surprise us. Go on." "There's a man downstairs. Richard Crown, a brewer. He came in looking for his wife, who fits the description of our Jane Doe. And we've got another one. Mamie Winthrop on Park Place."
Oscar let out a low but heartfelt moan.
"Who died at home this morning from what her husband is calling medical malpractice."
Larkin said, "Tell me that's not Albert Winthrop you're talking about."
"And just when things were starting to slow down," Jack said, "at least we won't bore each other to death."
Jack left Oscar and Larkin to question Richard Crown and headed uptown to Park Place. He hadn't been in the neighborhood since the day Sophie and Cap left for Europe, though he had told Cap he would keep an eye on the house. He asked the cabbie to pull over, paid him, and got out. The house was closed up. The windows shuttered. He checked the locks on doors front and back, examined window frames, and, satisfied, set off for the Winthrop place. He was halfway there when he heard a patrolman's whistle behind him and turned to see that he was being pursued not just by the cop, but 2 men. On the hunt, was what went through Jack's mind. He waited, hands in pockets, until they caught up.
"That's him," said the shorter of the 2 men, "nosing around the Verhoeven place, ready to break in. Arrest him."
The patrolman had the good grace to look embarrassed.
"Fred," Jack said, "how've you been?"
"Fine, Jack, we're all in good shape. There's some confusion here, Mr. Matthews."
"No confusion," said Matthews. "I saw him with my own 2 eyes. Now arrest him."
Fred Marks was a friendly guy, well-liked on the force,
well thought of on the streets. But he wasn't much for confrontation. He stayed on the job because his mother's sister was married to the mayor. But they kept him out of trouble by assigning him the easy duties that would normally go to the men ready to retire. Now his good-natured face took on a scarlet tinge.
Marks said, "Mr. Matthews, this is Detective Sergeant Mezzanotte out of headquarters on Mulberry Street.
I don't care if he's the Pope. He was trespassing."
The second man said something in a low voice, and Matthews turned on him. Jack saw now that they were father and son.
"I never heard anything so ridiculous in my whole life. Like the Belmonts would let a wop look after anything. Like setting up a cozy bed for the fox in the middle of the hen house."
Jack had had enough, but he let Fred give it another try.
"Mr. Matthews, I'm sure Mr. Verhoeven is glad to have you keeping an eye on his property, but you're mistaken here."
"Let's go home," said the younger Mr. Matthews. "You've done your duty, father."
Matthews looked like he was getting ready to make a citizen's arrest, or, more alarming still, to try to wrestle Jack to the ground. Jack held up one hand, and with the other he got his shield out of his vest pocket and held it up.
"Get in touch with Conrad Belmont," he said. "He'll tell you what you need to know. Now, if you'll excuse me."
He wondered what Anna would say if he told her about this, being accused of trespassing and attempted burglary on a bright summer day. She'd be mad. And so he'd keep it to himself. In the 12 years he'd spent on the force, things hadn't changed much. But he was older and could keep his temper in check, where Anna would not. He was still thinking about this when he crossed the street to get to the Winthrops' place. It couldn't really be called a house, this monstrosity in red brick, bulging with cupolas and towers, carved marble facings, wrought iron balustrades, velvet draperies at the windows, and a front door that would have been more suited to a dungeon. There was no sign of reporters, but he erred on the side of caution and walked around to the back of the house through the stable courtyard. The kitchen door opened and closed, letting out a single swell of sound. Female voices raised in alarm, frustration, fear. From farther away, a man's voice was raised in anger, too garbled to make sense of it. Jack pushed through the crowd of servants and stable boys, put his shoulder to the door, and forced his way into the crowded kitchen. A wiry woman who was just tall enough to bite his elbow stood in front of him, a wooden spoon in her fist, and murder plain on her face.
"Are you the doctor who cut up my mistress and left her to bleed to death?"
"No," Jack said. "I'm the cop who's going to track him down and see that he hangs."
A grim smile divided her face in two, but her eyes were wet and her hand trembled when she took his wrist.
"This way, then. Up those stairs."
She talked so fast, he only caught parts of the story she was trying to tell. Mrs. Winthrop had gone to see a doctor and come home half dead.
"She's a spiteful thing, mean as snakes, but nobody deserves to die like this, torn up like a fox at the end of a hunt."
"Wait," he said. "She's still alive?"
"She is, but just barely."
"Conscious?"
"In and out."
"I need to talk to her."
"I expect you do," said the cook, "but you'll have to get past Sir Albert first."
Jack wondered that the cook felt free enough to call Winthrop by a nickname he must surely hate, and decided she was past caring. Mamie Winthrop might be a wretched employer, but something about her had gotten the cook's sympathy. She pointed to a set of double doors and started to turn away.
"Tell me before you go, is there anybody in the house she takes into her confidence? Anybody at all?"
"Lizzie," said the cook. "Her maid. If not for Lizzie, the missus would be dying in the back of a cab or in a filthy hospital somewheres all alone."
A break, finally. The first real break. He said,
"Where is Lizzie now?"
"Packing her things. Fired."
"Don't let her leave," he said. "If you have to tie her down, keep her in the kitchen until I come to fetch her."
At the look on the cook's face, he said,
If you want us to catch the men responsible for Mrs. Winthrop's state, you'll keep her here for me to talk to.
He waited for her to nod and walked through the doorway into a sitting room that was crammed full of furniture, the flocked wallpaper barely visible under dozens of paintings and mirrors. He stepped around a sculpture of an Egyptian goddess, a set of couches upholstered in silk, a standing lamp in the shape of a heron with ruby eyes, through seating arrangements too delicate to bear the weight of anything larger than a cat, and arrived, finally, at the open door. The stench in the room was familiar. Infection, blood, human waste. Two men, almost certainly doctors, stood beside the bed, their heads bent together while they talked. Someone had pulled a sheet over the shape in the bed, blinding white but for the drops of blood that blossomed on the lower half. Alfred Winthrop was on a stool on the far side of the room, bent forward, his palms on his knees. There were rings on every finger, like extra knuckles of metal and stone. An older woman stood beside him, dressed as though she were going to a ball or royal reception. Her jewels were around her neck and hanging from her ears. Jack stepped into the room and closed the door behind him. Nothing was easy with old money. And the Winthrops were some of the oldest and richest of the Knickerbocker set. Lawyers came, surveyed the situation, and advised Alfred Winthrop to let the coroner's office take charge of his wife's remains, talking in low tones about inquests and investigations. A few well-chosen words, and Winthrop dropped his protesting and even agreed to answer a few of Jack's questions. No, he hadn't known his wife was enceinte, and she certainly had said nothing to him about a doctor's appointment. Ladies did not share such personal information, not even with a husband. They had been married 4 years and had no children, had wanted no children while they were still young and had so much of life to experience. They had made many plans for travel over the next year, and now it would all have to be canceled. To Jack, it seemed Winthrop was more worried about gossip than upset about his wife's death. That might be heartless and shallow, but there was nothing illegal about it. Hardly a half hour after Jack sent for him, the coroner arrived. In any other neighborhood, the wait would stretch out into days, but not on Park Place. Coroner Olson was new and intimidated by the casual display of wealth. Without much effort, Jack convinced him that this was a case that had to be handed over to Dr. Lambert at Bellevue. He anticipated some trouble from the lady's maid, who would balk at the idea of being questioned at police headquarters. Instead, he found her in the kitchen with two satchels, ready and eager to leave. Her life as a servant in a fine house had just ended. No one else would hire the young woman who had played some role, however small and innocent, in Mamie Winthrop's death. The harm was done, she told him, and a few hours in a police station would make no more difference. Jack observed her as the cab fought its way through traffic, jerking to a stop again and again, the cabbie raising his voice to curse at a newsboy, a cart driver, another cabbie who slowed him down. The woman he judged to be in her mid-twenties, very young for the position she had held, stared out into the city with a blank expression. The word that came to mind was comely. Even features, fine skin, and she was perfectly groomed and dressed for her station, which was to say her clothing was of good fabric, expertly tailored, without ornament or lace, not a speck of dust or a pulled thread to be seen. He asked a few questions, and she answered without hesitation or posturing, so that by the time they walked into the detective squad room, he knew the basics. Elizabeth Imhoff, called Lizzie. She was 25 years old, born in the servants' quarters of the Winthrop's Provincetown estate to a kitchen maid. A family by-blow, which meant, she told him with little emotion, that she had just been fired by her half-brother. She had known him all her life.
and he sent her off without a kind word or a reference. Her future was dark. Unless she had a beau waiting, a man who was ready to marry her and keep her, or she knew someone who would hire her to clerk in a shop, her options were limited. Women of Mamie Winthrop's standing could and usually did bring maids over from France or England, but instead, she had agreed to taking on a family embarrassment. He didn't know what to make of that, but he would have to find out. Oscar was writing down his notes on the interview with Richard Crown of Brooklyn, who had identified their Jane Doe as his wife, Catherine, and who had gone away to arrange for her burial, looking himself close to the grave. Now he sized up Lizzie Imhoff with a single glance, got up to greet her and shake her hand. She had a natural dignity, something Oscar appreciated, and showed her to a chair. The squad room was noisy with overlapping conversations about the day's biggest event. An especially stupid thief known to his colleagues as Halfpeck had tried to rob an opium den armed with a knife that wouldn't cut butter. It hadn't occurred to him that the owners might have weapons of their own, a lesson he had learned the hard way, but would never need again from his slab in the city morgue. "Let's get a cup of coffee," Oscar said, and set off without waiting for agreement. Jack brought up the rear, watching Elizabeth Imhoff walk, the way she held herself, the things she looked at. Her calm was unusual, almost off-putting, but he supposed she must still be in shock. Within a span of a few hours, her life had been pulled out from under her. Once they had settled into a booth at McNeil's, Jack saw that her hands shook a little. Not completely made of ice, then. It just remained to see how she responded to Oscar's interrogation. She listened to him ask the most general question possible. What had happened to Mrs. Winthrop? And returned with a question of her own.
How far back do you want me to go?
Start by telling us a little bit about her, Oscar said. She gave a soft laugh, shook her head in apology and laughed again.
I'm sorry, the question just takes me by surprise. I thought everybody must know Mrs. Winthrop, given the way gossip moves. But I suppose that it's a fairly small circle who would pay attention.
She had a reputation, then?
Yes, said Miss Imhoff. She had a reputation. The simplest description is probably all you need. She was spoiled, as most women of her class are, but she was also cruel.
To you?
To everybody. Her husband, her mother, her friends, if you can call them that. She was terrible to people on the street, to anyone who was less than beautiful, and to most beautiful people as well. And to the servants. All of us.
She paused.
I'm not sure how this is relevant to her death.
We'll get to that. How did she treat you? Did you like working for her?
God, no.
Glad to be shut of her, then.
She's dancing with the devil. The satisfaction I get from that idea will only last as long as my savings.
Jack leaned back a little, twisted his head from side to side to relieve the start of a cramp, and waited. After a full minute, Oscar said,
You know, we can ask questions and drag it out of you bit by bit, or you can just tell us. Wait, have you had anything to eat today? You are looking peaked.
Without waiting for an answer, he waved one of the McNeil boys over.
Scrambled eggs, toast, bacon, and keep the coffee coming.
Oscar tilted his head at Miss Imhoff, and she nodded. When she had some food in her stomach and her color had improved, she started talking. The story wasn't all that unusual or surprising. Mrs. Winthrop had been free with her affections. Over the 4 years of her marriage, there were 5 lovers that her lady's maid knew about. Simply because Mamie Winthrop took no pains to hide her indiscretions within the walls of her rooms.
And the husband? Oscar asked.
She gave a little half-shrug.
They went for days without seeing each other at all. They didn't argue, they just... She paused. They didn't seem to enjoy each other's company.
So no children at all,
Jack said. A son from her first marriage. She was a widow when she married Mr. Winthrop. The boy lives with his grandparents in Boston. Her tone never wavered as she told the rest of it, which said to Jack that she was very much in control of her emotions, as would be necessary in the Winthrop household. Over 4 years, I believe there was one miscarriage, and I know there were 3 operations. All of them were performed by the same doctor. I don't know why she didn't go back to him, Miss Imhoff said. He might have been out of town or retired, I suppose. She didn't tell me.
Did you go with her to those earlier appointments? Jack asked.
The doctor came to her. People came to her.
And why not this time, do you know?
She left it almost too late. I think she was tempted this time to have the baby and keep it. But then she decided she wanted to go to Greece. I know that because the modiste was called in and they spent an afternoon discussing the wardrobe she'd need in Athens in the spring. The next day she sent for the doctor to put things right. That's the way she referred to the operation. She was not happy to find out he wasn't available.
She discussed this with you?
Oh, no. She discussed it with her mother while I was in the room. She was furious when it turned out that none of the doctors she sent for would agree to do the operation. They all said it was too dangerous, past a certain point. But she wouldn't take no for an answer. Jack concentrated on taking notes. In his experience, it was best to leave the witness feeling as unobserved as possible. In the end, she did find a doctor, she went on. She was put out that he wouldn't come to the house, but he had the better of her and she knew it.
Do you know what he charged? What his fees were?
Oscar asked this crucial question in a casual tone, but she hesitated.
If you don't know, just say so.
She said, I saw her counting out the bills before we left. It was more than $300, but I don't know exactly how much.
Oscar prompted her gently. So you went with Mrs. Winthrop to her appointment?
Only part of the way. The doctor was very specific in his instructions, and she didn't want to chance scaring him off. She was supposed to come alone.
Jack said, That strikes me as odd, that she'd take such a chance. It could have been a trap of some kind.
Miss Imhoff's expression was almost amused. She took a pistol with her. She grew up with guns, apparently. Her father taught her to shoot when she was a child.
Not that it did her any good, Jack thought. Do you know how she found this doctor?
It was a crucial question, and the answer was disappointing. I assume she got his name from one of her friends. Rich women trade in information. Jack took down the essentials as she reconstructed the day for them. At 8 in the morning, they left the house in Mrs. Winthrop's personal carriage, with just the driver, a family retainer who was more than 70. On the way, Mrs. Winthrop had talked to her about a gown she wanted to wear to dinner the following weekend.
She thought she'd be able to attend a dinner.
Oscar sounded surprised. Well, yes, the young woman said. She was thinking this time would be like the last and the time before that. It never occurred to her that it might go wrong.
And where did the carriage take you?
She said. This is a little odd to admit, but I don't know the city very well, though I've been here since I was very little. We're not allowed to wander. I can describe the place the carriage stopped, if that will help. There was an elevated train station across from a day market, and a large courthouse just behind that. Kitty corner from the market, there's a little coffee shop. She gave me a dollar and told me to wait there, and then she walked away. 2 hours later, when she hadn't come back yet, I was getting worried. Then I realized that the carriage had left. For a minute, I thought Mrs. Winthrop had gone to a lot of trouble to be rid of me. But then the carriage came around the corner. I'm guessing she asked Cullen to meet her on a different corner at a different time, but I never got the chance to ask her.
We'll talk to the driver, Cullen, you say?
She nodded, turned her face away to clear her throat. Jack asked,
When you got into the carriage, what was your first impression? Did you think she was under the influence of some drug or other?
She stank of laudanum, Miss Imhoff said. So I think that's a fair guess. Her tone was clipped, almost cold.
Did you happen to see where she went? In what direction she went when she left you?
No, to be truthful, I wasn't all that concerned. Not until I saw the condition she was in afterward. As soon as we got home, she took some laudanum and then went straight to bed. Gave me strict orders. She was not to be disturbed for any reason. At 5 o'clock, I was to bring a tea tray, but I should come in and put it down silently within reach, and then leave again.
And did it happen like that?
She shook her head. At 5, I brought the tray in, but she was in the lavatory. I could hear her retching. I waited a bit to see if she'd call for help, but she didn't. I went back in about 2 hours later to get the tray and bring fresh towels. She stopped and studied her hands for a moment. I'm not sure how to describe the rest.
In as much detail as you can manage, Oscar said.
Another minute passed. She cleared her throat, and then she started more slowly. She was barely conscious when I came back. The bed was bloody, and there was a very high, keen smell, like a wound gone bad. She had gotten sick again, but right there in bed. So I said I would call for her doctor, and she woke up then and said no, it would pass. She'd be recovered by morning.
Do you think she believed that?
The aloof expression she had maintained for so long began to slip. She swallowed visibly and shook her head. I don't know.
What happened next?
Nothing. She let me stay. She wanted laudanum, and I gave her as much as I thought was safe. Then I lied and said the bottle was empty. She let me change the bed sheets.
Another difficult swallow.
But she kept bleeding, and she passed a lot of... I never imagined that the human body could produce such...
She shook her head. That's enough, I think, Miss Imhoff. Did anybody come to see her? Her mother, her husband?
Not that evening. Not until the next morning when I sent for the doctor. She wouldn't respond to me, and I felt I had no choice. Things moved very quickly after that. Her mother sent word to wake Mr. Winthrop. His rooms are on the other side of the house. And he came in just as the doctor arrived. He sent me out and told me to collect my things and be gone or he'd have me arrested. She looked directly at Oscar, the question plain on her face.
You've committed no crime, he said. There's just one more thing we need from you for the time being. We'll take a short drive, and after that, if you like, I can introduce you to a Mrs. Adams. She has a boarding house for ladies, very reputable and well kept. No doubt you'll sleep for 12 hours after the day you've had.
Oscar presented himself to the world as gruff, no-nonsense, unsentimental, iron-fisted. But he was also generous and protective with people who were in trouble they had not earned. The wonder of it was that he had not lost those traits after so many years on the job. Jack hoped he could only do half as well over time. He took Oscar home to Weeds for some supper and a quiet place to talk over the day. Coming in through the stable, empty as they kept no horse or carriage, they stepped out into the garden, and Oscar stopped.
Well, look here, he said,
spreading out his arms and turning, a dancing bear.
Now look at this. I could live right here, out in the open.
Jack was pleased with the garden, though he hadn't had much of an opportunity to sit in it.
Mr. Lee and my father put their heads together. They sent 3 wagons of earth and plants, conscripted the cousins, and this is the result.
They turned at the sound of the rear door to see Anna standing there. She looked a little sleepy, a pillow crease in one cheek, her hair escaping its pins.
I expect you spend most of your time indoors,
Oscar said under his breath, and Jack elbowed him, hard. Mrs. Cabot served her ragout of pork cooked in port with apples and prunes. Anna had to smile at Oscar's expression, as if he could not believe his good fortune. Mrs. Cabot kept house for a family who employed a French cook, Anna told him. This must be one of the recipes she took away with her. Over coffee and a plate of cookies, Jack said,
We've had a busy day, but we're still on duty until morning.
You just came home for your supper, Anna said, but I'm glad you did. I'll be leaving for the hospital before you get in.
Oscar cleared his throat. We have another victim.
Anna felt her expression freeze, but she took in a deep breath, picked up her coffee cup, and asked, Exactly the same?
In the essentials, Jack said. Nicholas Lambert would do the post-mortem, but there's little doubt in my mind. Oscar?
He shook his head.
But we did get some information this time, from the lady's maid. You remember the advertisements you found in the paper, the ones that mentioned Smithsons?
Jack said.
What's wrong? All the color just drained out of your face.
Smithsons? Her voice wavered a little. What about it?
There's a coffee house just opposite. Do you know it?
Oscar asked, his tone wary. Yes, Anna said. I used to go there with my Uncle Quinlan when I was very young. And she looked first Oscar and then Jack in the eye. I was there today. By the time they had exchanged stories, Jack got out his notes, both to be sure of the facts and to add Anna's observations. It was 8 o'clock. She started at the chiming of the hall clock.
I thought you had to go back to work.
Oscar raised both brows and tucked in his chin in what she thought was mock surprise.
What is it you think we're doing?
Oh, she said. I hadn't thought of it that way.
Your parlor is far more comfortable than the squad room, I'll give you that,
Jack said.
And it smells better.
I should hope so, Anna muttered. Is it too late to go to Jefferson Square right now, just to get a sense of how things are laid out and where Mrs. Winthrop might have been going?
Possible, but not the best idea, Jack said. You were there this morning, we were there a couple hours ago. If someone involved in this case happened to see us there again, together, it might well send them packing before we've even figured out who they are.
You think that's possible?
Oscar said.
Probable even. And after tomorrow, almost certain.
Jack took a folded piece of paper from his notebook and handed it to her. This will run in 5 newspapers tomorrow. Anna skimmed it and then looked at them.
This might help reduce the number of women who go to him, but how could it help in identifying him? The two men glanced at each other.
We have a suspect, Oscar said. We'll be watching him.
Can I ask who it is?
No.
Jack's tone was firm. Oscar scowled at him.
Come on, men. She's up to her eyebrows already. And if I have to remind you, she's been behind most of the useful information we have.
I know that, Jack said shortly. Anna said, Oscar, I know what this is. What we have here is the Brooklyn Bridge. The look on his face was almost comical, and so she explained. I wanted Jack to take me to the top of one of the arches, she said. This was before it opened. We had a philosophical disagreement about the boundary between protectiveness and paternalism. I think this is a similar situation.
Oscar was trying not to grin. And how did that turn out?
Not in my favor,
Anna said. But this time, it will. They took a break while Oscar went back to Mulberry Street to collect some materials. Jack took Anna's hand and led her outside to sit in the garden. Something Oscar said made me realize we aren't taking advantage of this. He gestured around himself. I keep meaning to look into putting together a pergola. Would you like that? Anna lifted their linked hands and pulled him toward a small bench at the far end of the garden. She said, This will do for the time being. So, you're going to have to convince me about Neil Graham. He considered for a moment.
Tell me first why you're so sure he's not involved.
These women may each have been desperate in her own way, but none of them was stupid. They had money, some more than others, but all of them were well off when compared to the average. They had households to run, and you know what that entails. She drew a breath and held it for a few heartbeats. A woman like this, with money and position, a woman who isn't stupid, isn't going to hand herself over to a 21-year-old intern. That kind of woman wants nice offices and treatment rooms and all the latest medicines and instruments. She wants anesthesia and laudanum and a physician with many years' experience. She wants decorum and white hair and distinction and manners, and she's willing to pay for all those things. Graham is polite and solicitous, but I can't see Janine Campbell or any of the others simply handing over a pile of money and then surrendering to his care. Have I convinced you?
Not yet, Jack said. But then you weren't there when Graham told us what it was like to examine poor women. There was revulsion, even hatred, in his whole demeanor. In his keen interest in the Campbell case and the others, there is some kind of connection.
I take you at your word, she said. After talking to Mrs. Smithson today, I wouldn't be surprised if she were connected, too. I have no idea how. Is there one simple scenario that pulls together all the small pieces?
That's what we're working on. Look, here comes Oscar with his maps and the rest of the case file. Anna.
She looked up at him, waiting.
Promise me something.
That made her laugh. Just like that. You want carte blanche on everything, or just one thing in particular?
I want you to promise me you won't go digging around Jefferson Square anymore on your own.
Anna grabbed his earlobe and pulled, ignoring his yelp, to plant a kiss on his cheek. That's the deal, she said. I won't go back there on my own. Satisfied? His brow pleated itself when he scowled, as he was doing now.
Savard, he said, I know you, and you've got something up your sleeve.
I will not put myself in harm's way, she said. I know very well that I'm out of my depths. I'm not foolish, Mezzanotte. What I am, what I've got up my sleeve, as you put it, is anger. I can't remember ever being so angry.
He studied her face for a long moment and then nodded. Let's go see what Oscar's got.
Chapter 42. The next morning, Jack caught up with Anna before she had reached Cooper Square, took her Gladstone bag and held out his free arm. He raised a brow at her until she took it.
I said I'd be home in time to walk you to work.
I wanted to get an early start, and you need to get some sleep, Mezzanotte. Mornings Anna was often on edge, but there was something more to her mood this morning. They had spent a good part of the evening poring over the surveyor maps of the Jefferson Square area, compiling a list of buildings within 3 blocks of the coffee house and Smithson's, where a doctor might have offices. It would take days for the officers assigned to the case to canvass all of them, but that was the next and necessary step. That, and a new and more intense look at Neil Graham. He said,
You didn't sleep well.
Not especially.
I wondered if this would happen,
She rounded on him, her brows drawn down, ready to be irritated. Almost, Jack thought, eager to be irritated. What would happen?
You, with your quick doctor's mind and quicker surgeon's hands, are finding the slow pace of the law frustrating.
They stopped at a corner to let an omnibus pass, wheels screeching on the rails. When they had crossed the street, Anna looked up at him. I had a dream, she said. I don't usually remember my dreams, but this one woke me and I was damp with sweat. After that, I couldn't sleep anymore at all. He waited, but she didn't go on.
You don't want to tell me about the dream.
I think I have to tell you about the dream. It goes on to that long list of things I need to talk to you about. Jack was tired, too. They had been called out to a street fight after midnight. Stevedores and sailors bent on breaking each other's heads. He thought about telling her this story and decided it would wait until they were both in better moods. In front of the New Amsterdam, he gave her her Gladstone bag, brushed a curl off her forehead, and kissed the corner of her eye, so that her lashes fluttered against his mouth.
You're not easily spooked, he said. But I'd be surprised if this case didn't give you some bad dreams.
She seemed to relax a little, her forehead pressed to his jaw, and still she looked unhappy, distracted, overwhelmed. He didn't like any of it, and there was nothing he could do for her in the here and now. I didn't dream about the case, she said finally. It was about my brother. I dreamed he came to apologize to me and I hit him in the head, with a hammer, but he was a ghost and he just stood there looking at me as if I'd disappointed him. Jack heard himself draw in a sharp breath.
We need more time to talk about this, he said. But I don't mind telling you that I thought when you got around to telling me about Paul, the story would be something else entirely.
I know. She touched his cheek with her gloved hand. I think that's why it's been so hard for me to talk about it. Everybody expects a story that I can't give them.
Anna, I'll take whatever you've got.
She smiled then, something almost regretful in her expression. We'll talk tonight. She went up on tiptoe to kiss his cheek, and he turned his head to catch her mouth. A soft, warm kiss. In need of comfort herself, she tried instead to comfort him. He kissed her back, possessively, hungrily, to remind her who he was. The operating room was one place where Anna knew she could drop everything and clear her mind. There was a simple hernia to be done, an operation she did day in and day out, but she was looking forward to it. Then she turned into the hall and saw Archer Campbell waiting outside her office door. Two thoughts went through her mind at that moment. First, that it would be childish and silly to run away, and second, there were times when she really did have use for a hammer.
Dr. Savard.
He dragged his hat off his head with a reluctance that spoke volumes.
Can I have a word?
Mr. Campbell, no, you may not. I have to be in surgery in 5 minutes. I'm just here to leave my wraps. She unlocked the door and went in, locked it behind herself, and took a moment to catch her breath. Then she went on as she had done every morning for as long as she had come to work at the New Amsterdam. She took off her hat, changed her shoes, and exchanged her shirtwaist for a fresh tunic and put on a full apron over that. The whole time she was aware that Campbell was still in the hall, waiting. She thought of Mabel Stone in the little cottage by the sea. She thought of Janine Campbell's 4 boys. Children she had never seen but could imagine nonetheless, if not healthy, then healing. As soon as she opened the door, Campbell stepped toward her, close enough that she could make out ale on his breath. She had faced down drunken husbands and belligerent mothers,